You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Good afternoon, and welcome to our conversation with Helen Wong. She is Chief Executive Greater China at HSBC. And for the next 60 minutes, we'll be taking a novel journey, an exciting journey down on several new roads to China. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. China, as many of you know, is a very important part of our Asia program. In cooperation with the Chinese mission to the EU, we run a very active Europe-China forum. And this year, as we mark the 40th anniversary of EU-China diplomatic relations, we've been working harder than ever before on different facets of this very important, indispensable relationship. And our hunger to know more about China just keeps growing. And that's why we're really delighted to have here with us Helen Wong. Helen, you have vast experience of China. You're well-placed to tell us a little bit more about China's economic landscape today and tomorrow. We're really, really interested in different aspects of China, and you'll see from the gathering here many experts who know a lot about different ideas, different insights and developments happening in China today. You have 25 years of banking experience in Asia, working previously at HSBC's China President and CEO, and you've led the bank's expansion into China, mainland China. We're also delighted to have with us today the ambassador, Chinese ambassador to the EU, Madame Yang Yanyi. And ambassador, I'd like to give you the floor now.
Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very grateful to Director of Policy Shada Islam and Friends of Europe for inviting me to this debate, New Roads to China, a conversation with Helen Wong. Indeed, against the backdrop of a more complex and intricate international situation and a weak global economic recovery, the eyes of the world are sharply focused on economic performance and outlook of China. Obviously, many experts, commentators, investors alike have adopted an excessively negative view of China's prospects, exaggerating current problems and touting China's sudden fragility. As pointed out by China Beige Book International, there is a history of global investors overreacting to problems in China. At times of obvious difficulty, those voices warning of China's unsustainable success and that China's economy will end up in tears could become more strident and that China disaster books would proliferate. Given this, I hope the keynote speech by Helen Wong could somehow help answer questions about China's economic transformation, the medium-term impact of China's reform of the RMB current parity, central parity rate, and the new strategic and business opportunities to be brought about by the One Belt, One Road initiative. Personally, coming fresh from the lately held 6th China-EU high-level economic dialogue, I wish to share briefly with you the main message of the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang on the status and direction of the Chinese economy during his meetings with the European delegation. Despite the main difficulties and downward pressure, the performance of the Chinese economy is stable and within the reasonable range and moving in the positive direction. Although difficulties remain, there are more opportunities than challenges. China is capable of meeting the main goals and tasks set for economic and social development this year, and this will lay a solid foundation for sustainable growth in the years to come. To further elaborate on that, as a $10 trillion US dollar economy, the 7% growth China achieved in the first half of the year has generated more increase in volume than the double-digit growth in the past and contributed about 30% to global growth. China's economic structure is improving rapidly. The service sector already accounts for half of China's GDP and consumption contributes 60% to growth. Growth in high-tech industries is higher than the entire industrial sector, and consumer demands for information, cultural, health, and tourism products are booming. Energy conservation, environmental protection, and the green economy are thriving. The extensive model of growth in the manufacturing sector is giving way to more intensive production. New economic growth areas are rapidly taking shape. Employment has steadily expanded. In the first 6 months of the year, 7.18 million new urban jobs were created. Surveyed unemployment rate in big cities was around 5.1%, and consumers now have more money in their pocket to spend, and price level has been kept basically stable. While China's foreign trade volume is slowing down, the actual amount of commodities China imported has gone up, and China's outward investment has maintained rapid growth. China will continue to follow a more proactive import policy and place greater emphasis on the quality of imports and exports. Last but not least, the ongoing comprehensive deepening reform, structural adjustment, and innovation-driven development strategy are unleashing the potential of economic growth and generating benefits. Though we have seen a slip or fluctuation in certain indicators lately, yet the policies and measures adopted in the previous stage are starting to pay off, and positive factors are building up in the economy. There's little doubt that the transition is a painful and challenging process. Ups and downs in growth are hardly avoidable and may have formed the shape of a curving wave. But looking beneath, the underlying trend remains positive. Putting in a nutshell, the Chinese economy is on the right track and its future will be even brighter. This is not unrealistic optimism. The Chinese economy is resilient, full of potential, and shock-resistant. The fundamentals underpinning a stable Chinese economy and featuring long-term positive trend remain unchanged. China's process of a new type of industrialization, IT application, urbanization, and agricultural modernization will serve to generate strong domestic demand. China's economy is developing in medium-high speed and towards medium-high level, which will provide broader space for both China and the EU to carry out cooperation in multiple sectors. China is not a source of risks for the world economy, but a real source of strength for world economic growth. To conclude, like passengers riding in the same boat, we all have a stake in each other's future, and we all should have confidence in our respective and common future. China is committed to opening still wider to the rest of the world, and there will be no change in China's overall policy on FDI. China stands ready to work closely with the EU to broaden and deepen their strategic partnership and mutually beneficial cooperation to promote global economic recovery, inclusive and balanced growth, and green and sustainable development. Together, we will be able to build a community of common interests and development and create an even better future for mankind. I wish today's debate thought-provoking and constructive. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, and all the different facets of China's transformation that you've pointed to open up business opportunities, investment opportunities for Europe and the rest of the world. So thank you very much indeed for that very comprehensive look at what China is like today. Now, I have said that this is going to be a conversation, but I've also promised Helen that she will get about 8 minutes to go to the lectern and give us an introductory analysis of where, how you see China today, and then the questions will start.
Thank you, Shada. Ambassador Yang, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It is great to be in Brussels, and thank you, Friends of Europe, for having me here. I've been on the go, actually, for the past week or so, flying to 6 cities in 7 days, and to see so many people at each event. I've been in, actually, New York, Washington, D.C., in Toronto, in Paris, and in Frankfurt yesterday. And really, seeing so many people is a testament to the growing interest in what is happening in China and how we can all benefit from the changes and the growth. I know that today's theme is New Roads to China, and this would hopefully, I say, Charlotte said 8 minutes, I hope I'll keep to it, But just want to set the scene, and by sharing some of the observations and some of the numbers that interest people. So obviously we all know that China's economic rise has been very impressive, and more so when we consider actually this is done since the reform and opening up, and which is about just 35 years ago. So imagine if you are buying something and you go to a vending machine and you put in a 20 cent coin, and then each time you get in return something that only worth 5 cents, and you're not happy about it. Perhaps, maybe an extreme description, but China perhaps before economic transformation was indeed like that. In 1978, obviously China was responsible for 22% of the world's population, but only 5% of its economic output. Since then, these percentages have shifted considerably. Well, last year, China's share of the world's population was 19%, when its share of global GDP has grown to 13%. So GDP is still not matching the share in population. Well, China is now the world's second largest economy, we all know, and if measured by purchasing power parity, it is ahead of the U.S. So China is also the world's largest trader in goods. And then, maybe to do a comparison that illustrates China's growing importance to the global economy without, you know, underestimating the U.S., but this is a quote from a recent edition of The Economist. The number of countries for which the U.S. is the biggest export market has dropped from 44 in 1994 to 32 now. Over the same period, the equivalent figure for China has risen from 2 to 43. So in the past 35 years, China's annual GDP growth averaged nearly 10% per annum. But now it is in a state of new normal, and I think Ambassador Yang described it very well. We are now defining China's economy by a slower growth but much more sustainable growth pattern. Well, HSBC expects the Chinese economy to grow. We're still holding on to that number, 7.1% in 2015 and 7.2% in 2016. Well, on China's economic slowdown, there are 2 points I would like to make before we have a conversation. A first point is that the slowdown can be partly explained by the law of large numbers. The bigger an economy begins or becomes, the harder it is to grow at a very fast speed. And the second point is that growth is slowing, but it is not stopping. So China's economic transformation is far from complete, and GDP growth will continue to be driven by different factors. Well, first one, obviously, is the change in China's economic model. For years, China relied on exports and state-led investment to power GDP growth, but now China is determined to develop a more service-oriented economy that is driven by domestic consumption. Well, in 2013, for the first time, the service sector actually surpassed the contribution of the manufacturing sector. And coming to the first half of this year, actually services accounted for nearly 50%, 50% of the GDP of China. But there remains ample room to grow. As a comparison, service account for 69% of Germany's GDP, 79% of France, and then 77% of Belgium's GDP. Well, another driver of GDP growth, obviously, is urbanization. In the past 3 decades, several hundred million people in China left their farms and go for jobs in the city. But despite this massive migration, China's current urbanization rate of 54% still lags behind that of other countries at similar level of development, which is typically 60%. And China's government has stated a clear target to reach 60% by 2020. Urbanization and the shift towards a more service-oriented economy works in tandem. Service sector jobs tend to be found in cities, hence a larger urban population is necessary if the service sector is to play an even bigger role in China's economy. Well, meanwhile, jobs in the service sector are usually higher paying, which leads to my next point, which is the rise of the middle class. As recently as 2000, the year 2000, only 4% of China's urban households were considered middle class. By 2012, that share had soared to 68%. Well, and although Chinese private consumption as a percentage of GDP is much lower than that of most other major economies, it has been rising rapidly. And I think China's phenomenal saving rates, is very famous too. Well, as Chinese consumers become wealthier, they will continue to buy, well, European luxury goods, send the kids abroad for schooling and travel, say, to Berlin, to Paris, and to Brussels. And in 2014, China recorded 117 million outbound tourists, more than 3 million of which visited Europe. Also, the recent stock market volatility has not put a stop to consumer spending. Retail sales data for August this year showed an increase of 10.8% from a year earlier, more than many analysts have expected. Well, last part, maybe I can just mention that China's economic rise is matched by the growing clout of its currency, the renminbi. Well, according to SWIFT, the renminbi is now among the top 4 world payment currencies by value, overtaking the yen in August. In the past 3 years, it has risen from number 12 with a share of 0.84% to number 4 with a share of 2.79%. You can say this is still a small number, but the growth in the speed of the growth is actually phenomenal. But today, more than 1,100 banks use the renminbi with China and Hong Kong. And it is the number one currency for Asia Pacific intra-regional payments with China and Hong Kong as well. But finally, I'd like to say a few words about the currency and its recent depreciation. That's one of the questions that I was most asked during the last 10 days. I think we can also cover it later in the discussion. But the PBOC's move on the 11th of August, cutting the daily reference rate by something like 1.9%, was reform-oriented, not aimed at devaluation. But reforming the foreign exchange regime has been on the cards for quite some years. We believe that the Chinese government will continue to open up the capital account and gradually achieve full renminbi convertibility. There is a famous phrase, I think, in Europe saying that when France sneezes, Europe catches a cold. I think today people say that when China sneezes, the world catches a cold. I think that's perhaps too extreme a way, and as ambassadors just said, economies depend on each other, they work with each other. China's transition, we believe, is healthy in the long run, and China's new normal means slower but more sustainable economic growth. A growing service sector, a continuous urbanization, and the rise of the middle class are 3 of the drivers that will power China's GDP growth. Chinese economic transformation began some 35 years ago, but is far from complete. And as the Chinese economy evolves, the world's economy will also evolve at the same time. This year marks the 40th anniversary of EU-China diplomatic relations. But trade and investment links between the two will only grow stronger as we begin a new decade. So I hope that is 8 minutes or less or more. But
thank you. Thank you, Helen. That was exactly 8 minutes, actually. I have a timer here. As you were saying, much has changed in China, and the ambassador was saying, in the last 3 decades. And really, keeping track of these transformations, these changes, is very, very hard work. It's also very difficult to sift fact from fiction. And what we want to do now with you in this conversation is to explore some of the concepts, the ideas you've raised, and to explore them further and to try and sift fact from fiction. So let's start with the recent market volatility that followed the devaluation of the RMB. You said in your intervention, no major change in the direction of the economy. Just tell us a little bit more about what you see changing. What is going to be the same? What is going to change in this fundamental basic that you said is not really at stake?
Thank you. I think we talk about a lot about the volatility in China this year. And so people ask me, what's the impact, right? The stock market rising up 100% can crash quite a few percent a day, not a month. And but when we look at China, we have to go back to the point what China's economy is growing on. If you look at the stock market, interestingly, when you look at the stock market, it's definitely not a mature market as we look at it. And one of the reasons for the volatility, I think people talk about over-excessive leveraging, but then indeed, you can also look at the performance of the investors. And the domestic market is actually having more than 70% of its investors from the retail sector. So we do know how retail investors actually behave. They somehow actually go always at one direction. So that is one reason. So there is a reason with this volatility that China has to continue to improve or reform its stock market. But when we come to talking about the impact, obviously, interestingly, if you look at the financial holdings of people in China, less than 15%, 15% is in the stock market. And this is actually not counting the rather heavy investments of people in China in real estate. So I'm talking about financial investment. More than 15% is roughly 60%. It's held as a financial asset in cash and deposits. So to that extent, so you would think that even there's a big crash at a whatever time that we do not like, it is not really having a very big impact on people, on investors. The second thing is the stock market actually contribute to about 3% of the funding to the society. So in that sense, the volatility in the stock market hasn't really would not have such a big impact, you know, on the fundamental of the economy. So I mean, that is how we look at it. But when we say changes, I probably cover a bit in the opening remarks. And indeed, China is still reforming the country. I talk about urbanization. This will be a driver. We talk about when you talk about urbanization, obviously you have to look at infrastructure because you're moving people into city, and people in the city do go back to their home, to their hometown, to visit their parents, for example, or other relatives. You talk about what is the infrastructure like today in China. My China economist told me actually the length of the railway of China at this point of time is shorter than the length of the railway of the US 100 years back. So there is still a lot of need to build infrastructure. If you look at the cities in China, if you look at what we call big cities, which are 5 million population and above, there are perhaps close to 80 of those in China. And most of these cities do not even have a subway. If you look at Shanghai, comparing Shanghai's railway map to Tokyo, Shanghai having something like 20-odd a million of people, Shanghai does need to continue to build a lot more subway. There's someone who also asked me to say that, well, is China overbuilding its infrastructure? But if you go and live in Shanghai, and if you try to ride on the subway, you will know we need that.
Right. So what you're saying basically is that the fundamental picture is not changing, but we can expect ups and downs in the course of this rather miraculous development.
Indeed. I think we have to remember that we call China an emerging market.
Yeah, right.
And we have to remember that it started to open up only 35 years ago. So it's interesting, someone actually mentioned to me, saying that especially the financial markets, because it started really developing north 35 years ago, but more recently, mm-hmm. when you say that if we think that China's capital markets is more like a teenager, then the teenagers tend to be a little bit irrational, tends to be bold in what it does,
right.
Tends to try to change things, may fall, but get up rather quickly. So it's perhaps a good way to describe China's capital markets.
Right. And Helen, you said that the HSBC forecasts also put growth in the coming year at around 7.1%. But we have heard other economists talking about just 3% growth in the coming year.
I think it depends on the, ultimately, I noticed that Ambassador is not here, so maybe I'll say that. I think it when we look at 7% growth, we do count on the fact that China it's committed to that growth. So when we say if China is committed to that growth, meaning there are ways of China to actually achieve that growth. So we talk about infrastructure investment.
Yeah.
We talk about actually financial reform, right? We're actually talking about very few countries in the world has such a high deposit reserve requirement in China. It's still almost 18%. So imagine if they release three percentage points
yeah.
from the reserve requirement ratio, and then maybe they do faster on the infrastructure. It's quite easy for China to actually achieve yet another 2 to 3% growth. So if growth has weakened to say 5 and 4, and if China's determined to shift it. There are many ways to do it, and there are indeed this capability and measures that China can do to do it.
And I suppose that the new plan that will be coming out in 2016, the new five-year plan, will probably try and focus on these kinds of bursts of energy which they can do at home. I just wanted to turn now to the different transformations you talked about. And one of the things that really struck me was that the rising middle class numbers are expected to go from 250 million today to 600 million in the coming decade. And that obviously, as you said, opens up vast opportunities for exports, for investments, for all kinds of market-driven changes. Give us a little bit more of an idea of how you see this changing. What would be different about China's consumers?
A lot of people saying that they find it surprising when they visit big cities like Shanghai, like Beijing, the amount of the buying power that they see, and if you go to actually just trying to get I wouldn't say the best restaurants, but if you go to reasonable restaurants in China, it's for the big city is always very packed. The consumption obviously, and if you look at just how many people actually own a smartphone, and the way they start to spend, I think the China is facing, for a lot of the middle class is facing the same thing, right? Meaning housing the place you stay in becomes smaller because cities are getting more expensive, but then you are spending more money on many other things. That is very similar, perhaps, to some other developing market. I always reflect on Hong Kong, where I come from, and to an extent, China is facing some of the things that Hong Kong is facing. Developing very fast, a lot of middle class are rising up, smaller families, and China has always has sometime a one-child policy. So smaller families, smaller housing, but spending more on better quality of food. Better chances of going out for tours, for visit, and you must have read from the news. We just have the national holidays. The amount of tourists actually touring the country, and actually touring nearby countries, for example, Japan, because of the strength in the currency of RMB against some other currencies in Asia, the amount of people actually leaving China to do other things. It's interesting. When in the past, staying in Shanghai, when you have a big holiday, I do see a lot of tourists from some other provinces who go to Shanghai. On recent year, interestingly, actually you see fewer tourists in Shanghai because they have begun to travel overseas.
And what about the investment in services? The direction is now going towards more of an effort to develop services. This is going to be quite important for banks and for investors as well.
Yes. I think for banks, because I'm a banker, let's start from there. If you're talking about more services, financial services is part of it. Mm-hmm. So, the one thing that the banks try to obviously serve is the retail demand for wealth management products. Mm-hmm. And then obviously you would then hopefully as there's more middle income class, you would have that sort of wealth shifted a little bit more. Perhaps hopefully manage to convince that people would save a bit less in cash and deposit, but invest in some other thing. So, but that will happen. So, for banks, we obviously do target that. On the other hand, we do want to see that the capital markets, begin to actually be open a bit more, and China is already starting doing that. For example, stock market, I think we all know that there is a Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect that was launched last year in November. That is actually, we see it as really significant because it is indeed the first time where this is truly a two-way direct access of the stock market. And then China is also opening up the bond market a bit more. China in recent years have opened up what we call the interbank bond market and have welcomed sovereign wealth funds and central banks around the world to invest in the China interbank bond market. They used to run a quota system, mm-hmm. But in July this year, the PBOC announced that they no longer need to apply for a quota to invest. I mean, not to talk about China continues to open up by granting more renminbi QFII license to various countries in the world. At the moment, there are 13 places or countries having our QFII license to invest into China, and that amount is about 1 trillion RMB at the moment. We do expect that to continue to increase. So not to say that China also continue to encourage trade settlement in renminbi and investment in renminbi. Today, China's ODI is more or less surpassing China's FDI. So, and on the, a lot of the outward investment actually is actually made in renminbi. So be it that would be an FX exchange, by the time it arrives in a certain country, but 60% of the ODI of China is now denominated in RMB. And the more China does, obviously there is business for other countries.
So what's the implication of, is the renminbi sort of China's gateway into a more global economy, into the mainstream global economy? Is that the internationalization of RMB is a gateway, right?
Well, yeah, I think definitely for an economy as big as China, it will be just hard to say, to imagine that it doesn't use its own currency to buy and sell and trade and invest. It's just because the RMB was not fully convertible, a capital account was not convertible, that a lot of the trade is denominated in other currencies. So we see this as a natural way, and the more RMB is used in various parts of the world, mm-hmm. the easier or the faster that the currency will become fully convertible.
Right. And do you foresee the inclusion of the RMB in the IMF special drawing rights?
Well, I believe this is this will happen. It is not whether it will, but it's when. At least that's how I see it. I think according to IMF's definition of a convertible currency, actually China's currency now, perhaps according to data released by PBOC, actually meet more than 40 items of the definition of a currency being convertible. So I think that is a really good chance that China will get into SDR.
Right. I have a few more questions for you, but I would really like to open the floor as well. Could I have a show of hands to see how many people would like to come in at this point to ask questions? Okay, thank you very much. Could I have the roving microphone, please? The rules of the game are very simple. Two hands. Please, could you put your hands up again? Yeah. Can you see? Yeah, please go there first. Please identify yourself. And if I could make a plea for short and snappy questions.
Sure. I'm Jorge Valero. I'm a journalist from Euractiv, Brussels-based media. I have a question regarding the recent announcement by the Chinese government, his willingness to contribute with the so-called Juncker plan. My point or my question is, as you said, that there is huge investment needs in China itself, and at the same time, China has its own brand new development bank, the AIIB. So my question is, what is China's interest in participating in Juncker plan? Is it rather, let's say, a tool of soft power in Europe, or there are real and, genuine interest, economic interest in Europe?
Thank you for the question. I think I must admit that being Asian or spending most of my time in China, Hong Kong, I do not understand the full details of the Juncker plan. But obviously this is an investment plan as far as I see it, and a lot is about, again, infrastructure. Actually, I think this tally very well with the One Belt One Road initiative of China. A lot of people ask me how exactly would the One Belt, One Road strategy or initiative unfold. I said, we also do not know. But we do know that this is a firm commitment and an initiative for China to engage its neighbors, actually maybe far away neighbors in Europe, on actually stimulating more flows for China in trade and in investment. And in services and in capital as well. People said, well, China needs investment domestically. Yes, I do talk about it. You need railways, you need subway. But China also has a lot of reserves. It has also have a lot of, in a way, capacity, in particular, for example, in steel and iron, etc., to be able, you know, to help to actually share. When I say share, it is indeed creating business opportunities for a lot of the Chinese companies who have the ability and the ambition to expand their business overseas. I have talked to, for example, some of the bigger construction companies in China, and they are already identifying projects along the road and about. And obviously, China is, yes, actually leading the establishment of the AIIB. But the fact that I think 57 countries have signed in into it, that shows that people do buy into this idea of building the world in a way, you know, along a clear corridor in that sense, and then putting money into it. And it's interesting when people are saying, but is the money enough, right? But I think ultimately we're not just looking at the AIIB. We are not just looking at the Silk Road Fund. We're not just looking perhaps in the EIB or the EBRD. Mm-hmm. We are looking at private interests as well. You know, when the projects are identified, a lot of these projects are actually supported by local governments, etc., then the private sector will actually naturally go ahead. Mm-hmm. So I have actually companies asking me, well, would HSBC want to form a fund to invest into One Belt One Road projects? Yes. So in a way,
what do you say?
Well, obviously, any opportunity we'll consider. Yeah. So interestingly, I think when we say the government doing it, but the government is obviously very interested to see the private sector going for it too. So I would not just. I thought coming back to your question, I think it's a natural thing that Chinese would want to work with Europe on in the infrastructure front. In particular.
And the discussions are underway at the highest level. I think that's clear, and there's interest on both sides. So thank you for that answer, Helen. I saw my colleague here as well. Yes, I've seen you at the back. But could you take the microphone? Could you put your hand up again, please? Yeah, there.
Hello, Aris Kokinos from Eurobolt.com, journalist as well. Mrs. Wong, can you tell us how do you consider the new evolutions in the Syrian war and the consequence it will have on the price of oil? How do you expect the price of oil to evolve in 2016? If you can tell us.
Yeah, and, you don't want to take that question. You don't. No, would you?
And the impact on the Chinese economy, of course.
Well, I'm definitely not an expert in that area. I don't think I can take that question. Yeah.
But thanks for trying. It's always useful. Gentlemen at the back, please.
Thank you, Ms. Wang. And just to pick up where Ms. Shada just left off, just telling fact from fiction and going back to the financial services industry, what would you have to say about the recent selective use, allegedly selective use by Chinese authorities of the anti-monopoly law that is being denounced by AmCham and the Euro Chamber of Commerce on the one hand, or the restrictions placed on certain manufacturers and service providers, ITC manufacturers and service providers in the financial services industry? Thank you.
Well, thank you for that question. I think as a banker who have actually, in a way, doing business in China four times, and as a bank invested, I would say our bank is rather heavily invested in China too. We will look at many laws and regulations in China, not just one. And we tend to look at how things are involved, how does that actually impact us, whether it is providing business opportunity in the right manner. And it will be very difficult just to pinpoint on one particular legislation. And for me, it will be looking at the environment to see that whether it is an environment that provides growth opportunities. And I see China continue to provide growth opportunity. And indeed, as an investor in China, we would like to actually grow with that opportunity and be all the time doing all the duties of a citizen in China, as a bank citizen, as a corporate citizen. So I'm afraid that may not be the answer, but indeed, it is really the potential, the opportunities that would interest us.
So the bigger picture, rather than narrower sectors, what's happening? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There was a question here, please. Yeah, and I'll come to you. Yeah.
Philip Deras from the services unit in DG Trade. I mean, you mentioned rebalancing in China, which is very healthy, increasing share of the services economy, which is good. But the question is, to what extent will the services economy become more open? I mean, there's massive demand and challenges in China, asset management, fund management, huge opportunities, expertise from European banks. But when we look at the figures, share of foreign participation in China's banking sector is about 4%. In insurance, it's less than 2% and even decreasing. So we hope that for the second biggest economy, largest trading nation, that should not be a new normal. Now, HSBC has been one of the very few foreign banks that have made successful inroads into China. How did you manage to overcome those challenges? What can others learn, and how do you see prospects for hopefully more competition also with foreign operators in the Chinese market?
Thank you. I think that's a very good question. You're overstating the share of foreign banks in the China market too. Actually, it's less than 2%. Interestingly, foreign investors in the financial sector has grown over the years. But the market share hasn't grown. Actually, at point has actually retracted. It's because the Chinese sector has grown even faster. So you have seen days where the big PRC banks have grown something like 30% a year. So it's a period of time where that market continues to demand a lot of financial services. So it is never easy. We all know that it's never easy to do business in China because of regulation, because that the country, as I said, coming back to that same point again, hasn't really opened up that long. Right, for foreign banks, it's really only after China entered into WTO that we will be able to start to engage in renminbi business. So you if you're talking about a foreign financial sector investors, it is really 10 plus years that you're starting to build your business there. So looking into the future, I believe that it will be continue to be more open. But if you understand China do know that financial sector is very important. And it's a famous, I think this is a famous quote in China. It's you have to feel the stones as you cross the river. Because you do not know if you suddenly, you know, just make the currency convertible, you liberate interest rate, what would be the impact in an economy that big with a population of 1.34, 1.35 billion people. So I think that is a good reason why it is slower than we expected. But going forward, I am actually quite optimistic. You ask how HSBC, somehow, doing well in China. I guess one fundamental principle is we never waver on what we believe is the opportunity. So we somehow were started in China, so naturally we have an advantage because we were born 100 years back in Shanghai and Hong Kong. So our brand actually does help us. But in a way, it is the commitment that we have for that market that we have not actually really, you know, take away. And whenever there is opportunity, we'll just catch on to that. And there is a lot of anticipation of how changes will come by. So it's like before China talk about or launch the free trade zone, you're almost ready. Mm-hmm. So you're almost ready, you're prepared. When it open up, then you are there. So I think it's a lot about preparation. But I do see continued opportunity for more foreign participation.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Please, sir. No, just here in front.
Gerhard Stahl, I'm a professor at the Peking University HSBC Business Business School. So I have to praise your bank to be intelligent, to invest in education together with the Peking University. My question concerns a bit the development of the future banking structure in China. As you know, in Europe, we have a bit two schools. We have the Anglo-Saxon system of capital market-oriented financing, and we have more a continental European system, maybe best represented by Germany, an office where you are now in, with strong regional banks. And my question would be a bit to you. How do you see the further development in the opening up of the banking sector in China? Will it go towards the Anglo-Saxon capital market-oriented way with bigger investment banks, or will it leave also enough space for regional banks, a bit following maybe the model of the German saving banks? I know there are discussions with Chinese partners on the different schools. So what is a bit your feeling about the future, about a blueprint for the future banking structure in China?
Well, great question. Perhaps this has to be a very personal view because I definitely can't speak and I don't know what the blueprint is going to be like. But if we look at China, we have to actually understand that you travel to China and you do know that it, to an extent, it is one economy, but it is many markets because different provinces, the economic structure is perhaps different. I mean, we not all know very famous. Shanghai is aimed to be an international financial center. If you ask a lot of the multinational companies who are already in China, some are actually in 100 cities, but they perhaps will focus on where they actually can sell the products. And so if you look at different provinces, they have different needs to that extent. And I do believe that there is room for regional banks to play. In China, there are already different types of banks. I do know some banks who focus entirely on SMEs. In China, there are rural banks who actually focus on actually in rural areas. Actually, interestingly, HSBC has invested in the rural banking sector too. We do have HSBC rural banks. So in a way, because the country is quite diverse to an extent in its economic development, I always feel that there are room for different banks. I wouldn't necessarily call it this continental, you know, sort of way, but there should be room. The key thing is how to make sure that when banks are targeting different sector, they have the same equal treatment when the country opened up. It's the financial sector, and then we engage the right regulations to make sure that all these banks grow heavily, that they do not actually, because they are engaged perhaps in the lower credit spectrum, that they would then be not able to survive. So, for example, China in engaging, hopefully, you know, more financial services to be provided to the rural sector. Some of the very strict banking laws would be relaxed for this type of rural banks. So I do believe that that should be the case.
Thank you. I saw two hands go up at the back, right at the back, actually. Yeah, could you please pass the microphone there?
Sorry, Ifulhan from CREAB. I just was wondering with regards to convertibility of RMB and the now launch of SIPS, how you see the SIPS infrastructure developing and progressing. It obviously is limited scope and working hours at the moment in terms of the reference of, you know, the global markets. But what are your views on this and how this will match up to already existing global infrastructures?
Thank you. I think before SIPS was launched, we do think that as RMB begins to accumulate it in various centers in the world, we're using a more, perhaps more complicated or less efficient clearing system to clear the renminbi. Now that China has launched, and indeed this is just last week, right? So recent SIPS, which is the cross-border settlement system for RMB, and participants actually is not just local banks. There are foreign banks involved in it. HSBC is one of the first batch of players. And I think this system now provides what we call a system that offers more international standards. Technically, it's very difficult to actually describe it technically, but so far the system after a week has actually been run rather smoothly, handling thousands of transactions. Hopefully this would provide the system to clear renminbi in the future so that wherever you are in the world, you will be able to clear or settle renminbi efficiently. I think that is the whole purpose. And with an efficient system, hopefully that will stimulate the use of RMB further. And as again, China is opening up its market, its financial market. The healthier, the more efficient it is, the easier it is for it to open up. Because then you won't find it difficult if you start to invest in China that you have problems or you have delays in settling your currency. So I see it as a healthy development to support the internationalization of the renminbi.
I saw another hand go up at the back. Am I? Yeah, please.
Thank you. My name is Ángel Pérez Sainz. I work formerly with the European Commission. I would like to ask a question. Volkswagen is hugely present in China, massively present. Probably is the most important car producer. I don't know exactly. But now, you know, we are in a crisis about the reliability of the measurements they do for in terms of environmental performance of their vehicles. The issue has ramifications in several areas, in economic, labor, certainly the environment. The question is a little bit, have you seen in China any reactions towards the issue? Do you anticipate any measures by the economic consequences, economic financial consequences for Volkswagen? And in particular, are the Chinese authorities taking into any measures to take into account the environmental issue, which is very important in China, also, by the way.
Thank you for the question. Thank you. Helen?
I think on this, I'm as much as you watching very closely the development. And I think whenever something that has an impact on the markets, on the economy happen, we all are very concerned. We all watch very closely. I perhaps haven't actually read much more than you do on that, and can't comment on what China's reacting to it, on how. I haven't read perhaps enough to actually know how China's reacting to it. But as again, anything that happens that impact the market, I am very sure that the Chinese government would pay a very close attention.
That's right. If there are no more questions from the floor, I would... Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't see you first. Yes, could you... So, if there's anyone else who wants to ask a question, can I please see your hand now? Because... okay, all right. Please, go ahead.
Thank you for talking, Mrs. Wong.
Can we ask for shorter questions now? Because time is running. Thank you.
I'm Varun Agarwal from Maastricht University. My question relates to the aging population of China as being one of the major sources of pessimism amongst economists. You talked about various factors which influence GDP growth, one of which is labor. So my question to you is, in your opinion, how much of a hindrance that is, the aging population in China, to the Chinese growth stories, and what can the Chinese government do to counter that, to meet its growth targets? Thank you.
Helen, before you answer, I'll take the last two questions as well, and then that way we have... So there's a lady here. Yeah, hi, sorry.
Yes, my question is actually... Claudia Vernotti from China U. My question is related to the one of your active before regarding the Juncker plan. Because before you answer the questions that people ask you about the possibility, I mean, the interest the HSBC can have to establish a fund for the One Belt, One Road. So then my question is, are you interested or would you be interested or considering to do a similar thing also for the Juncker plan? So to have a fund maybe can be a regional one or can be a sectorial one for the Juncker plan.
Thank you for that. And then I saw... gentleman over here.
Good afternoon, Cornelius Huppertz from the permanent representation of Germany to the EU. My question is also dealing with connectivity and the One Belt, One Road initiative. So where do you see Chinese priorities in developing this not very specific concept of One Belt, One Road? Where do you see first-hand priorities in developing it, in particular towards Europe? And if you were to set up such a fund to invest in the One Belt, One Road or connectivity project, where would you see from private sector point of view, would you see priorities? Thank you.
Thank you. I think those are three very good questions.
Yes.
Helen,
starting with the aging questions for China, I think, yes, that is a fact. I think I read some research to say that actually the generation of manpower in China will max in 2017. And then after that, it would actually goes down. I read a research to talk about that. But I think we have to look at China also from an angle that we have to look at productivity too, right? When you have the market actually growing and as actually people age, but we are talking about the current workforce would become more productive. And that has been the case. So China's direction should be really thinking, actually making its workforce actually more productive. And then you have to actually travel up the value chain. So that would counter, the impact of the aging, issue. So we think aging is an issue, but it is not like that it will impact China immediately in the next 10 years. There will be time when that question will become, that issue may become more, you know, more impacting. So for the next 10 years, we do see that obviously productivity will continue to improve in China. So how does China counter that? Also a personal view, obviously relaxing the one-child rule, actually continue to develop cities, which China is doing, changing the composition of the economy. So all this they are also doing. And ultimately, obviously, China will need to build a better, you know, pension service and all that, which China is indeed looking at. So I think this is perhaps a question not uncommon to many countries as well, and China definitely looking at it. The investment in Juncker plan. I think the question is whether HSBC is interested. And not to speak on behalf of my European colleagues, because I look after Greater China. I think anything that comes up with a business angle, the bank would definitely look at it. I think the bank has expertise in certain area in particular. For example, we do a lot of green things. So we are active in green bond. We are active in a lot of the project. I think our project financing skills are pretty good. And if I'm referring back to One Belt One Road, that is exactly what we're looking at. Is indeed what are the projects that we can use our expertise to support. Not necessarily forming a fund, but I mean all the different types of financing that the Juncker plan and the One Belt One Road can consider, we would hope to be able to provide that sort of advice. And ultimately, yes, the fundraising, why not? If it is it's a good piece of business. What I think that question leads to: what are the projects that would be the good ones? Yeah, I think as a bank, if we are responsible to our shareholders, we would be interested, obviously, in projects that will provide a good return, and that would be providing a good return not just to the investor, but also that would be beneficial to the economy. So we would be focusing to sector that actually fulfill the goals of countries. For example, I have to use green energy yet again, because that would be very, very important for China going ahead in the next 5-year plan.
You did mention green energy and green financing, and with the COP 21 coming up and the Chinese presidency of the G20 next year, they have put the greening agenda quite high up on their list of priorities. Any comments on that? What are you doing?
I think this will be actually be very important. And if you are talking to various provinces as well, this is actually on top of many big cities. Shanghai talks about it, and I was recently in Chongqing. Chongqing talks about it. Chongqing is a city of 30 million people. So this is high up on the agenda, definitely. So, and I think China is really, really asking for advice, from the world. When I said I was in Chongqing, obviously, the Chongqing mayor just have his advisory council. And people sitting on the advisory council are foreigners, are people from various different business sector. So I think, yeah, just to say that it is really high up on the list.
Okay, Helen, we're coming to the end of our conversation, and it's a question I often put to my interlocutors when they are women, which is happening more and more, which I'm very glad of. There were 3 women here today on the panel. There aren't many women in senior management positions in banking in Asia or in Europe. And I was wondering, more personally, what are the challenges you face, and why do you think that goal of parity has not yet been achieved?
Wow.
Yes,
this is not something I expect as a banker. But I think, interestingly, in Asia, perhaps I have seen more senior women bankers. Perhaps because we just need the resources. I mean, Asia is a rapidly growing economy, and we just need all the people that we can use, I think. But to me, I thought growing up in Hong Kong and actually entering banking, I have never actually felt much restriction as to actually trying to work hard and contribute. And perhaps Hong Kong is just a very, special market. But everything comes back to needs, right? So I would hope that, more women would have, I think they will be provided opportunities, but whether you think you want to, grab those opportunity. The Chinese culture still goes very much as to women would look after the family perhaps a bit more. So, but I guess that if I really have to say something on this issue, I would just say that in work, I never think about the fact that I'm a woman. I'm just thinking that I am one of the many, many colleagues who are working together to achieve something for the organization. So whether I'm a woman or not, it doesn't really matter.
And personally, are you doing more for younger women in your sector, in your bank? Do you see yourself as being kind of a mentor?
I do, but I don't think there's any particular formula in that. I think the first thing that, if I can be very frank, as woman, I think the first thing is really to stop thinking about we are any different from a man. When I say that, it's not, I mean, we are different, but the important thing is you're focusing on a piece of work. You're focusing on a role. You want to perform well. Then don't think about any limitation because of gender. There should be no limitation in that sense. So I would always advise my fellow women colleagues that at least that is how I look at things, right? I don't feel any particular uneasy among a big boardroom with many men around. But that is just a fact. I would just say that.
I didn't think you would feel uncomfortable. but let's go back to business for a second. I said in the beginning, things are changing so fast in China. It's difficult to keep track. How do you keep track? What do you do? Do you count every morning? Do you wake up and think, this has changed, this has changed, this is how we're going to respond, this is what we're going to do? How do you do it?
The first thing, you have a plan. And then you have a plan, you have a commitment, and then you think of whether you have a team. But again, to know more about China, you just have to be there. I think just simple. But today, obviously, I think reading Chinese is something that is beneficial because actually China's social media is so powerful. You can read a lot actually just by following some of that. But have to be there. I mean, if you're not there, it's very difficult to gauge what is happening and have a feel. And of course, in my job, I do talk to government, I do talk to regulator, I do talk to peer group and all that. But to understand a fast-moving market, you just have to be there.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Helen Wong for this very...
Thank you very much to have me today. Thanks, Charlotte.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for really bringing China to life for us in very, very different ways, in very different sectors. It's been a pleasure to host you.